You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. With the release of his latest book, Pascagoula Uncovered, Philip Mantle presents a treasure trove of new evidence, transcripts from hypnosis sessions, and new witnesses from this compelling case. We cover some of the new information included in the book, as well as what was featured in the companion documentary series, Pascagoula 73, available now on Prime by filmmaker Darcy Weir. Philip has also allowed me to include an incredible recording of Calvin Parker's hypnosis session with the legendary Bud Hopkins from back in 1993, which you can listen to after our conversation concludes. But before all that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and merch, as well as visiting our exclusive merchandise site with TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel for his wonderful art, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys. So then, let's join Philip as we discuss Pascagoula Uncovered. ...1973 now seems to be a seminal year in the history of ufology, with encounters occurring all around the world. From Missouri to Ohio, Mississippi to New York, there seemed to be no end to these reports. Building on his previous excellent work in regards to the Pascagoula case of that year, Philip Mantle has released a treasure trove of previously unseen material relating to the case in Pascagoula Uncovered. In conjunction with Darcy Weir's new documentary series Pascagoula 73, both work in conjunction to shed a far bigger, broader stroke of this case for us all to enjoy and understand more. Philip, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters, my friend.
Yeah, good evening, Paul. Nice to speak to you again.
Always a pleasure to spend some time in your company, Philip. Well, before we started about this, I mean, we were chatting, as we have done many times about this case, Philip. I've known you now 7 or 8 years, and you've always been a very kind and supportive person in regards to your time, to connecting me with people, introducing me to people all around the world. What I knew about the Pascagoula case when I first met you, compared to what I know about this particular case now, thanks to the sterling work you and some of your colleagues have done over the years, is incredible. Even with all your experience, Philip, from them early days working with the Bird Souls and that meeting that you got the bus to in Leeds many, many years ago, my friend. Do you think this is the most important UFO case you've been involved in?
Oh, without a doubt, Paul. Without a doubt. I mean, I think it's, and I'm not being big-headed and there's no ego in here, I think it is the seminal case of this type anywhere in the world. And the work that we've done, and that includes myself, Dr. Irene Scott, and assisted by various other individuals and organizations, too many to mention, is an example of what we as humble UFO researchers can do when we work together. You know, because when we started down this road, looking back at this case, you know, it was dead and buried. I initially found Calvin Parker just for an interview, and it's gone from there. But down the years, I thought, right, you know, I started working with Calvin, and I asked him, have you got any of this or any of that? And he said, no. He says, I lost everything in Hurricane Katrina. His house was literally by the river. He was 10 or 12 feet underwater during the hurricane. So we started from scratch. All we had was his memory and his story No documents, no photographs, no nothing. I mean, zilch, zero. So I, you know, cast the net and see what we could find. And it's amazing how colleagues are, you know, in different parts of the world said, oh, I've got some newspaper cuttings, or I've got some pictures or whatever. You can have these, Philip. So we were assisted, you know, in many different ways. And then published Calvin's own book. It was called, you know, Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter. There's a play on words there because one of the original investigators was Dr. Hynek himself and Dr. James Harder. And we took it from there. And Calvin, you know, did some local media, and he was now being taken seriously, and they weren't pulling faces at him and laughing, which then encouraged other people to say, well, hang on a minute. You know, we were out driving that night, and this is what I saw. And I don't give a damn if nobody believes us anymore. You know, I'm of that age, I couldn't care less. Hmm. And one thing led to another. And here we are, you know, 5-6 years later with more information on a case that was practically dead and buried, you know, back in 2018 when I contacted Calvin. And in my humble opinion, and people don't have to agree, it is now the best documented case of its type. As simple as that. And the information continues to grow, and we'll see where it leads.
I'm staggered, Philip. I really am. Because I can't think of another case in my memory.
Look, your three main abduction cases are all American. You've got Travis Walton,
yep.
Betty and Barney Hill,
yep.
Pascagoula. Mm. Travis Walton had no independent witnesses. They were all his friends in the truck.
Yep.
You know, nobody else come forward and said, I saw something that night and, you know, I've got some documents or I've got this or I've got that. I mean, nothing. Same with Betty and Barney. I mean, I believe these people, don't get me wrong. You know, Betty and Barney traveling home from a holiday in Canada, driving in the middle of God knows where when the incident happened.
Yeah.
And there's very little. I think there was a couple of reports around the time reported to a UFO group. But that is it. And most, if not all, of their information is based on the hypnosis tapes. Again, I'm not knocking the case at all, you know. But here you have with Charlie and Calvin, there were witnesses that came forward at the time.
Yeah.
One of the chapters is called Jerry Booth, and he appeared on TV in 1973. And the reason he knew it was the date and the time is because he was watching his favourite TV programme.
Yeah.
And it was Kung Fu with David Carradine. I remember watching it myself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, probably a year or two after it had been out in America, but I remember the series.
Yeah.
And he knew the date and time because he'd been watching his favorite TV show. And he went, you know, so, and then we had others. And for I'll give you an example, Paul. I spoke, Charlie and Calvin, after their encounter, decided not to tell anybody. So they were driving home and Charlie had a change of heart. They pulled in at a convenience store and he used the payphone. He first phoned Keesler Air Force Base, which is about 30 miles away. They said, thanks, but we're not interested. So he rang the sheriff. And the sheriff, the it went via the police to the sheriff's department. The dispatcher who answered that call that night is still alive. And he told us, he said, I must have taken 50 plus reports of UFOs on the phone that night. And he says, at the end of my shift, when I went back to the station, there were people there in person reporting it. So he's the guy who spoke to Charlie on the phone that night and put him through to the sheriff's department. And he's still alive. And he said, you know, there were 50 plus people. So we thought we might get one or two, you know, come forward, or we might find one or two. Now, I got my colleague, Dr. Irena Scott from Ohio, on board because she's a lovely lady in America, not some chap across the Atlantic speaking to you with his funny accent. And I asked Irene if she'd help me and interview some of these people on the telephone. And I asked her not long ago how many interviews she'd done, and she thinks it's now over 50. So I'll give you an idea of the amount of other individuals in and around the area. And then you look at, the UFO groups that were involved at the time, and there was a huge wave of sightings across the United States that year. But the epicenter was here in the South, and the peak time was October, which is, you know, where Charlie and Calvin's encounter is, right in the middle of it. And of course, where they were located, where they went fishing on the river that night, you think it's an out of the way place, but it's not. It was a bit of a dump at the time.
Yep.
You know, not now. It's all being cleaned up. But there was a road bridge and another bridge either side of them. There was shipbuilding on the other side of the river, and was both business and commercial properties behind them. So this wasn't in the Mississippi swamps. They drove up to the place, you know, parked the car. So perhaps we shouldn't have been so surprised. And one of the criticisms back in 1973 was that nobody driving over the bridge that night saw anything. Well, they should have said, just changed this statement, is that we haven't heard from anybody.
Yeah.
But we did.
Yeah.
But we did. And he's a chap by the name of Charles Rusty Anderson.
Yeah.
And he'd been out that evening with his wife, and he was driving over the bridge, and he said he saw this blue thing, which is what Charlie and Calvin saw, and he thought it was an aeroplane, but he said, I thought it was going to crash, because he literally looked down from it below him under the bridge.
Mm.
And the next day he went to an aunt who lived down by the river, and he said, before I had a chance to say anything, she all said to me, you'd never guess what I saw. And not only that, I think the last year or the year before, Rusty put a little post on Facebook that he'd seen this thing. And I'm reading his posts and the comments underneath. And there's a lady with a completely different name said, oh, I saw something that night. So I contacted her, said, could we have a chat with you, please? And Irina interviewed her. And she was about a mile in the opposite direction from the bridge. And she said, I'm putting my child to bed. And I went to close the curtains, and we could see out across the river, and there's this big blue light over the river. Lo and behold, she was actually the cousin of Charles Anderson, Charles Rusty Anderson. Neither of them knew each other had had the sighting, yet they were all part of the same family.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked Rusty, I said, did you tell anybody? He said, well, you know, and then we had a chap by the name of Lewis Lee. Mr. Lee went to a book signing that Calvin was having in Pascagoula, and he bought a book, and he's chatting away, and he says, oh, I saw something that night, and then he was gone, and nobody took his name, but somebody was taking photographs, and we had a picture of him. So I put it on social media, and it was a lady at the local library said, I know this gentleman. So I explained who we were and what we were interested in, and could we speak to him? She said, I'll ask, and he said, yeah. And Mr. Lee, God rest him, has since passed away. He was actually on the other side of the river working in the shipyard that night. He was a crane operator. And he said, you know, my cabin, the crane was about 10 or 12 feet off the ground. And he says, as soon as I looked out, I could see this thing over the river. So not up in the sky, you know, actually out over the river. And he said it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen, this blue thing. And to him, it was almost transparent in the middle. And he watched it for some minutes. And then his colleague down below shouted to him, you know, words to the effect, you know, what are you doing?
Hmm.
And so he turned away. And when he turned back, it had gone. And I said to Lewis, I said, did you tell anybody about it at the time? He said, well, I told my family. I said, did you report it? He says, Philip, this is 1973. Who the hell are you going to call? There's no Ghostbusters, you know. And then, of course, when it comes to the documentary we've made, Pascagoula 1973 with Darcy, when Calvin's book came out, he did an interview for a local journalist, a lady by the name of Karen Nelson, and she was quite skeptical. But by the time she'd been interviewed, Calvin, she changed her mind, and she also met a little TV thing to go with her article online. She got a little mini documentary that lasted about, I don't know, 6 or 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Somebody grabbed that and put it on YouTube. And there was literally hundreds of comments, Paul, and I'm reading through them. And there's one from a person that said, my mum and dad were on the opposite side of the river that night. and they too saw the UFO. So I found this turned out to be a young lady, and I said, this is who we are. Would your mum and dad speak to us? She said, I'll ask. She said, yes, here's their telephone number. It was Mr. Jerry Blair and his wife, Maria Blair.
Yeah.
And I first spoke to Maria on the telephone, and she was, you know, more than willing to speak. And she told us that her husband, Jerry, at that time in 1973, worked offshore. So they were literally on the other side of the river that night. They got a boat there, but they were waiting for the boss to come, and he was late. So they were waiting in the car for him. And Jerry went best pleased, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So eventually they decided to walk down this little pier and put Jerry's clothing and what have you on the boat. And Maria said, we saw this blue thing come down the river, and it stopped opposite us. And she said it was either looking for something or it didn't know where it was going. Mm. Now, she knew the area. She knew there was no airfield there, no helicopters or anything. So while they're walking down this pier, she says, there's this almighty splash in the water next to her. And these were her words. This grey man came up out of the water and literally was right in her face. And I mean, nose to nose. So she couldn't see an awful lot of him because he was that close. She said, then went back down under the water and never came back up. She ran to the boat. She chucked her husband's stuff on it. And she said, this was about 9 o'clock-ish. She then went back to the car. When she got back to the car, it was about midnight.
Mm.
And she said to me, she said, she couldn't really explain it, Paul. She said, I can see something out of my peripheral vision, but I can't quite make it out. So eventually she got in touch with Calvin. Her and Jerry appeared on a local news item, but they only talked about seeing the blue thing. Jerry would hardly say a word.
Mm.
You know, he begrudgingly admitted seeing the blue light. And then, sadly, Jerry got seriously ill.
Yeah.
He was in a hospital, and he made Maria, his wife, phone me from his hospital bed because he was going to have an operation the following day, and I wasn't sure if he was going to make it.
Yeah.
And he said, Mr. Mantle, I lied. I saw everything my wife saw. I just didn't want people making a fool of it. And he made Maria film him as well. So we have him on this mobile phone footage, like sitting on his hospital bed. He's still got stickers on him from when he's had an ECG.
Yeah.
You know, got a shirt on.
Yeah.
And then he said to Maria, got something to tell you. And he said, we two were abducted. And he told her the whole story. And then when he told her that story, these things that she thought she could see in her peripheral vision now made sense.
Mm.
She could see out of the sort of left-hand side that Jerry had been confronted by these things. And there was this big light right up them, not over this other side of the river now, but right up close. And, you know, he told her the whole story, and she gave him hell fire, Paul, yeah, even though he was seriously ill, you know?
Yeah.
She said, you got some damn talking to do. So what I did, I passed this on to Dr. Scott, and she kept in touch with Maria and Jerry. And, you know, Maria would tell us a bit at a time because Jerry was very ill. And it was almost like a deathbed confession, although he didn't die overnight. You know what I mean? It's the same kind of thing. And God bless him, even with his last few breaths, he was still trying to tell Maria what happened. And sadly, he passed away. So Maria came to us and said, you know, I know Calvin at some point had hypnosis. Could I have it? And I said, look, you know, you've not long got over your husband dying, you know. I put her off, basically, Paul.
Yeah, obviously.
Then X amount of months later, she come back and asked again. I said, well, I'll see what I can do. So I just got some contacts on online and hypnotherapists around the area. And I got one young lady called Crystal Slaughter. She says, yeah, I'll do it. And she says, I'll even go to the client's premises if you like. You don't have to come here. So we picked a date, and we actually had it done at Calvin's house.
Yeah.
Because Maria had got to know Calvin and Wayne, and he'd obviously been through it before. But with the hypnotherapist, we didn't tell her anything. about what we were discussing. We just gave her a date, a time, and a location. And I also hired a professional guy to film it. So he filmed it with two cameras, you know, one close up, one side on. And we filmed it. And, you know, we weren't really expecting anything, to be honest, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, and I know there's arguments for and against hypnosis in these instances, and I understand that. But she started to tell us that these creatures, whatever you want to call them, were interested in her eggs, and that they wanted to make beings that could walk amongst us unnoticed. She was extremely emotional under hypnosis, and we have it all on film. And then I wanted to get Maria interviewed face to face. I couldn't get the guy to film it. He was just so busy.
Yeah.
You know, I think when we paid him, he sort of gave us mates rates almost. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But he was, you know, he had to do it for a living. So there was a lady in the area called Chelsea Norton Prince. She runs the Ocean Springs Historical Society and has an interest in the case and had met Calvin and bought a book. And she'd been very helpful. And I said, look, could you interview Maria? Do you have an iPhone? She says, yeah, well, the iPhone footage is good enough for what we want. So I sent Chelsea a number of questions, and she got Maria sat in this room and fired away. And she told us more about what had happened. But not only that, we then had it on film. It wasn't just he said, she said. And one of the questions that Chelsea asked Maria was, when did you first meet Calvin Parker? We were expecting her to say 2018 or 2019, you know, and she didn't. She said, I first saw him when he got abducted.
Yeah.
She said, we could see what was happening on the other side of the river. She said, I didn't think it was strange creatures. She thought it was some kind of man-made episode that was going on, you know?
Yeah.
And she claims that she's been in touch, but she's had another sighting since then. And she's had more missing time episodes. And, of course, you get to see lots of this in Darcy's documentary, you know, for the first time. And Maria's there. You see her hypnosis and her interview. You see Calvin under hypnosis. So a few weeks after Maria was hypnotized, we put Calvin under hypnosis using the same hypnotherapist. Obviously, she knew the subject matter now. So I sent her a couple of questions to ask Calvin. And I said, I want your first question to ask Calvin. Well, he stood there on that pier that night before anything happens. You know, he's got his fishing rod in the water. He's looking out over the river. What does he see? That's all I want to know. So she asked Calvin that question. He says, well, I can see the river, the bridge. There's a boat going out. He could even tell me the company name of the boat. And he said, and right at the end, Paul, he said, oh, and there's two figures on the other side of the river. And then he, you know, if you don't listen to it, you'll miss that.
Yeah.
Now, were those two figures Maria and Jerry, or was it somebody else? I don't know. But just a little thing he said right at the end. And, of course, we filmed that. We have that on film. It's shown, you know, as an exclusive on Pascagoula 73 that Darcy has made. Like we were chatting beforehand, one of the things we've accumulated as well is an archive of material from the time.
Yeah.
And Darcy's done brilliantly piecing it all together. And, you know, they were on the Dick Cavett show with Charlie. Charlie and Calvin went on the Mike Douglas show as well. We haven't got that film, but we're still looking for it. Is anybody out there has copies of those? We'd be most grateful. But, you know, we didn't realize when we started down this route there would be all this archive material, but there was. And I think Darcy's done a brilliant job editing it all together. And it creates the story in real time, but using a lot of vintage material. But then we bring it right up to date with Maria and Jerry Blair and what Maria has told us, you know, and what you see on the film as well. You can doubt the hypnosis. I don't have any problem with that at all. But you have to remember, she told us an awful lot before any hypnosis was conducted. So even if you say, well, we'll take the hypnosis testimony out of the story, we still have one hell of a story. So what was thought to be originally a story about what happened to two guys fishing on the Pascagoula River that night of October the 11th, 1973, is now much bigger than anyone ever imagined. Mm. And it continues to grow to this very day, Paul. And you can watch the whole four-part series for the price of an expensive cocktail.
Yes.
And you can buy the book, you know, for a couple of what would cost you for a couple of beers.
Yeah, yeah.
And the book almost follows on from the documentary in many ways, because, you know, obviously we didn't stop researching things once the documentary was made. And I've uncovered other things afterwards, which are in the book. Mm. So, like you said, they do complement each other.
I always find hypnosis sessions, Philip, quite challenging to watch. Not in the fact that I don't find them interesting or entertaining. I find them quite chilling.
Well, they can be, yeah. I mean, when you look at Maria, she was very emotional.
Yes, yeah.
And we pre-warned her. What may happen, we said, you may remember nothing, because I've witnessed that myself.
Mm, yeah.
And people will cast doubt on it. I asked Calvin about hypnosis. I asked him the question, had hypnosis ever helped you at all? He says, not at all, Philip. I remembered it all anyway. And he said, you know, what the hypnosis did for him was clarify one or two small points. But he said, I could remember it all anyway. So I'm not bothered. If people don't believe the hypnosis, that's fine by him, because he remembered it regardless. And he told people the story pretty much before he'd had any hypnosis. I'll give you one example.
Yeah.
And it's not featured in either of these accounts because I can't support it. And Calvin, God bless him, he's no longer with us. But in 1993, he had another encounter. This time he was out in a little boat fishing by himself. I won't go into all the details, but he was taken up, same alien creatures, and he tried to kill the female one. He'd had enough, and he had a period of missing time. A pal of his, he told, and he said, his pal had a bit of interest in the subject. He says, you do know that there's this guy called Bud Hopkins is into all this stuff, and he's actually at a conference this weekend in Florida speaking. So Calvin and his buddy got in the car and drove to Florida, turned up at the hotel where the conference was, and Calvin's buddy went in and spoke to Bud. Calvin wouldn't go in. He didn't want anybody to recognize him. Now, I knew Bud, and this just sounds just like him. He gave this guy, who he'd never seen before, his hotel key. I said, I'll meet you in my room afterwards. So he did. He chatted with Calvin, and they agreed to put him under hypnosis. Thankfully, Bud recorded it, and I have a copy of that tape.
Mm.
Now, Calvin told all the details about it, but going back to the 1973 encounter, he talked about that as well. He also related two things that happened to him as a young boy. But when it came to the 1973 encounter, which is what we've been discussing tonight, he was driving his brand new Rambler car. And as they're driving up to the fishing spot, they passed another car. The car was parked up, and there was a courting couple in the back of this car. Now, previously, Calvin could remember the colour, the make, the model, etc. of this car, but he couldn't remember the registration number. Under hypnosis, he gives out the registration number.
Yeah.
And when I transcribed it, I didn't edit it out. It's still there. Calvin told me the story that at some point he hired a private detective to try and find who owned that car with that registration number back in 1973. And he said, you know, they found the two people. One of them, the male, had passed away. But the female occupant of the car that night was now pretty poorly and in a nursing home. And Calvin went to see her. And She only agreed to speak to him on the basis that he would never release her name. So he spoke to her, and she said, yeah, we saw the thing take off or whatever. Because Calvin had a little vision of these red taillights disappearing in the distance. Now, I've never told that story because I can't support it. I don't know who this lady was, you know, but I found Calvin to be a very honest man, and I believe him. But were it not for the hypnosis, he would not have found that registration number. So hypnosis, in his mind, clarified little things for him. As simple as that, you know. And it's a terrific story. Whether it's, you know, I don't doubt him for one minute. But it shows you that's another way that hypnosis can, in my opinion, bring up little details that may well be correct. And if Calvin's story is true, then obviously the hypnosis has worked on that occasion.
Well, exactly. And that proves he's not just pulling things out of thin air, Philip, because if he was, then how did you find the reg plate?
Exactly. Because when I spoke to him about it, he told me the make, model, colour, etc. And not only that, he said there was a tag on the car. Now, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. There's a tag. What the hell's a tag? Well, on the number plates in America, they have a little sign that tells you which state it's from. So we even knew the tag, where it was from, but he couldn't remember the number plate. But under hypnosis, he did. Now, and like I say, you know, all that's been published. People can make of it what they will. Same with the documentary where we show Calvin's hypnosis and we show Maria. You know, people can make it what they will, but they must remember that they told their story before they underwent hypnosis. One of the reasons we put Calvin under hypnosis is A, because we had the opportunity to do it, and B, we could film it. You know, I've only got it on audio previous sessions, so we now had it on film as well, and saved it for posterity, so to speak. And, you know, whether you believe in the use of hypnosis or not, it is part of the story and it can't be ignored. You know, and that is it. But what myself and my colleague, Dr. Irina Scott, decided right from day one, Paul, was to publish anything and everything we could lay our hands on and allow people to draw their own conclusions. You know, we're not out to indoctrinate anyone and tell anyone, you must believe this. No, this is what we've uncovered. This is what we've found. This is our opinion, but it doesn't mean it's your opinion. You judge for yourself, you know, simple as that.
I think the thing that strikes me about this, Philip, is the amount of interest there was at the time. And as we've mentioned previously, it just seems to drop off the radar. Do you think that it just got lost in the 80s obsession with cases like Roswell? And despite the fact you'd got Charlie and Calvin around talking to people, Charlie especially doing interviews left, right and centre. You know, the guy released a record about the whole thing even.
Yeah, he did.
Which you've got a copy of, I believe, Philip.
Yeah, I do, yes.
and yet, you really had to sort of look deeply in the 90s and noughties to find anything about this case. The first thing the first time it popped up on my radar, really, in the last decade or so, is when Charlie Hickson passed away, which I think was about 2013-ish.
It was 2011 when Charlie passed away.
Yeah.
But he'd been the torchbearer. I mean, Calvin really was, you know, hidden away. He did a couple of interviews in 2013 with local media because it was the anniversary. And then he disappeared again. And this is what we found out about Calvin's life. I mean, he didn't want to tell anyone about this story right from day one. Right. If he'd have had his way, nobody would have heard of it. He just got engaged. He was getting married the following month. And he was sure that if this story got out, his future father-in-law was going to say, you're not marrying my daughter, in that case. Luckily, he did marry her. But within 12 months, under 12 months later, you know, Calvin had been harassed by the media, left, right and centre. What a lot of people don't know, he's joined the Royal Marines. He joined the Marine Corps in America.
Yep.
And he joined to try and get the hell out of the way. And he thought, you know, the news media won't be able to get me here. Well, they did find him. And, you know, Calvin went to see his commanding officer and told him, and they gave him a conditional discharge. It was only in the Marines, I think, 9 or 10 months. And in the new book, I have his military records. I think Calvin also punched somebody because he was a tough guy, was Calvin. I think one of the other reasons they let him go was that I think somebody might have tried to make a fool of him about what had happened. And, you know, that was probably the wrong thing to do. And he got more than he bargained for, you know, because the Marines are not going to be soft guys either. Let's be honest, Paul, you know, but
no.
They picked on the wrong Marine that day, I think. But he got, an honourable discharge, and I have his discharge note and all the other stuff. It's all there. But it shows you to what lengths it would go to hide. You know, that's quite severe. And this is still, Vietnam is still going on.
Yeah.
So had he lasted, he could well have been posted to Vietnam, and heavens knows what may have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And but he would become a recluse. He took his family. He even made up a false name at one point, so people didn't recognize him. He got fired. Yeah. He tells a story where he apologized to Wayne, I don't know how many times. They were living in Laurel, Mississippi at the time, and she sent him out for a loaf of bread one night, and he woke up in New Mexico 2 weeks later. he'd been beaten up, he'd been robbed, he'd been mugged. You know, he was drunk as a skunk, and he didn't really drink. He was never a drinker. And he apologized, and that was just what happened to him. And he wished, when we told his story and we finally got it out, he wished he'd done it sooner. But I said, well, you know, you've done it now, Calvin. And one of the reasons for doing documentaries like this is, you know, Calvin and I became very, very friendly. And God bless him. I spoke to him a couple of days before he died. And I said, I'll be the torchbearer for you, Calvin. And he said, I just want to leave my legacy. He has a daughter. And he said, I just want them to know, I want everybody to know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, Pascagoula Uncovered, there is a piece that Calvin wrote a few years back now. And he said, don't publish this until I die.
Yeah.
Because it was then he'd first got ill. And whilst we didn't have a diagnosis, I think Calvin knew deep down that this was not something he was going to recover from.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he was right. So we wrote it. I haven't done anything with it. I've just corrected the spelling errors this time because he's not here to tell me off. And it's in there. So that's Calvin's last word. And that's in the book in Pascagoula Uncovered. You know, and like we say, it follows on from the documentary rather nicely.
I honestly can't believe how many seminal people were involved in this case, Philip. These are the things that have really confused me about why it's taken happy coincidence for the last sort of 7 or 8 years for this story to get the credit it deserves, Philip. Because you look at the people who were involved at the beginning, like you've mentioned, we've got Hynek there, we've got James Harden there, we've got Bud Hopkins involved. These are some of the most important researchers of that era, and it's almost as if, regardless of all the other work that they did, this case just didn't seem to resonate outside for some reason. And with you finding these lost app profiles, with that woman who bought Charles Hickson's old house, Philip, and there was two boxes of correspondence in it still.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is
yeah.
One of those incredible things that you just treasure trove of delights inside there. Or even things like what happened with Stefanos when he got transferred at the last minute to a boat that ended up taking him to Pascagoula. There's so many weird things about this case that you think, how on earth has this, every time you think it's going to get out there again in the 80s and 90s, something else turns up, or you get somebody pretending that they've got an alien corpse on a table and they filmed it, Philip. Or we've discovered something about Roswell once again. I cannot believe that so many important people were involved in this case, that it was allowed to sort of settle and drift away until you and Calvin sort of came together. And then the last 7 years, it's a whole different story. Now we all know it. Now we've got all these reams and reams of television interviews, of footage from the era, from news bulletins. notes, documentation. You've got the original hypnosis with Harden as well, which had been lost decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like I said, I'm not being big-headed, and it's not an ego, but the work we've done on this case is an example to any UFO researcher stroke investigator of what can be done. As long as you do it in the right way, be polite, be professional. You know, I get something off one gentleman, and he'd say, "Here, Philip." And then a couple of years later, he said, "Oh, you know, I've been running through my files, and I found this other bit. And here you go." So they knew you were working on it. They've been a pleasure to work with. "Oh, I found something else. I know who's interested in that. Be Philip Mantle and Dr. Scott." And that worked. And we got stuff from all over the world. Got newspaper cuttings in I don't know how many languages, Paul. I've got UFO magazines that were made in and around the time. You know, the kind of handmade things.
Yeah.
I've got those, copies of those in languages that I have no idea even what even language they are. And they're telling the story. I think I told you before we started, we found out that Fleetwood Mac, one of their songs is called Hypnotized, and it's partly based on Charlie and Calvin's encounter. And I found that story in a music magazine. It's not made up. We found out that in 1976, an Italian television company had made a two-part TV movie. It's called Extra. It's in black and white, and I've got a copy. I don't know a word they're saying because it's all Italian. Calvin had no idea about this, totally bemused, you know. So it's, you know, we continue to unearth material. We continue to unearth witnesses. Not all the witnesses have come forward. We found some by chance, you know, some using a bit of detective work and some by pure luck as well, Paul, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
But it all comes together. And again, I think it's a seminal case now that is up there with any of them, because it is all there. There's everything there that you want. And that's the reason that the book that Dr. Scott and I co-authored, we called it Beyond Reasonable Doubt. And I was watching a courtroom drama on TV one night, and we're writing this damn book, but we didn't have a good name for it.
Yeah.
And it said, "Oh, we have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt." And he went, "Boing." And I emailed Irina. And I said, "What about this?" Because our argument is, if you took all the witnesses and all the other stuff that we have, and if we could present that in a court case, we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that something really bizarre happened that night. Not that they were abducted by aliens, and never proved that in a million years. That may be your own conclusion, but we could prove that something really extraordinary did take place. Because we have physical evidence as well. We have marks on Charlie and Calvin that were sent to us from the Center for UFO Studies. We have the photographs. We have a letter describing them being examined and seeing these marks. So we have physical evidence as well. But we have witnesses by the zillion, you know?
Yeah.
And hence the first book, Beyond Reasonable Doubt. Simple as that.
Yeah. How did you and Darcy come together to pull the documentary together then, Philip? Because obviously you're an executive producer on this, and you feature in it as well in some of the segments, my friend, as I said, peppered with some of these wonderful vintage pieces of footage that Darcy's been able to track down from American Network over there at that particular period. And as you say, other aspects of it, and some touches on some of the other cases that were going on. Because as I mentioned in the introduction, 1973 now just seems to be like one of the craziest years in the history of ufology. One of my personal favourite cases is the coin case, because that guy took no shit at all, Philip. And I love that case, because he's like, "Right, this has just happened. I'm going to have a press conference straight away. Here's me mates. We all saw it together. This is what's gone on." And you start looking at 1973, and I know some people consider it to be the year of the humanoid, don't they, Philip? Because there are so many cases, and obviously Dr. Scott's found other instances of strange things happening further up in Ohio where she lived, this strange boom that happened that year. You have numerous excellent UFO cases that are all very different to things that seem to have happened in the previous decade. So this documentary series, I think, is outstanding, because not only have you got all this archive footage and you've got interviews with people and other such things, you've obviously got the footage of the hypnosis sessions. So did Darcy approach you, Philip, or was this something that you'd gone out with?
Yeah, I've been, you know, Darcy got in contact because he was coming to England anyway, and he was going up and down the UK, and he came here, and he filmed an interview with me about the, you know, the Pascagoula case, which is what you see in the series, and we took it from there. And you know, I'd explained to him previously how much information we did have. Obviously, as a documentary producer, he wants to know what visuals you've got.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just going to be, you know, made up stuff. It's going to be the cheap and nasty stuff that you find online sometimes, you know. But yes. No, I said that we've got an archive, an ever increasing, and I've got exclusive, you know, the hypnosis film professionally. And we've got, you know, and that was it. And we built from there. We originally thought maybe we might do a two-parter. And then, of course, as I'm sending Darcy material, it grew and grew and grew. We could have gone on and done, you know, still been at it, making the series. But you have to stop somewhere.
Yes.
We wanted to make it informative, but not too long that people would get fed up. And I think we've done that, or I should say, when I say we, I mean Darcy.
Yeah.
He's the guy that's put it together, and so it just works well. And Darcy is a cracking fella to work with. He kept you informed, and when he said he was going to do something, he did it.
Yeah,
you know. And when he said we're going to have it edited, when he said I'm going to get some artwork done for it, he did. And the artwork that we've had to use at times is, you know, outstanding.
Yes.
And it's not your cheap clip art that you see in some of these documentaries. It's been specially produced for us. Mm. And that was all down to Darcy. And then I've got the archive that I just said, just tell me what you want and I'll send it. And hey presto, we ended up with a four-part documentary that obviously I would recommend to anybody for the few pounds that it costs. I know, you know, people have a difficult financial situation around the world, as we are now, but it's not a huge I tell you what, it's cheaper than going to the cinema.
Yep.
The last time my wife and I went to the cinema was before I was ill.
Yeah.
Cost me £62.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I think, £7.99 on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And it goes on for a lot longer than the movies do as well. You know, so, and of course, I've got to be biased. We've got several books on the case. The latest one is Pascagoula Uncovered. You'll not be disappointed, but you know, it's not a fortune. Please have a look. Please, if you can, support us.
Absolutely. Well, I commend you once again, Philip, for adding even more spice to this incredible case over the years. And as long as I've known you, every time we talk, we seem to find something else. The film series that Darcy has created is phenomenal. I recommend it highly to anyone who's interested in this particular case and ufology in general, because I think it shows that if you go looking hard enough for these kind of things, Philip, you will find them. And thankfully, with your diligent research in conjunction with people like Stefanos and Dr. Scott and some of the other people that you've been able to reach out to in and around Pascagoula over the years, we've got a completely different case to what it was 10 years ago. And I can only thank you for all your hard work and also for taking the time to speak to me on this particular case in regards to the book and the documentary, Philip. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, Paul. And Pascagoula 73 on Amazon Prime, Pascagoula Uncovered on Amazon. Take your pick.
I'll put the links into everywhere as usual, my friend, so people can track both down. I want to say thank you so much and an absolute pleasure to speak to you, Philip. You look after yourself and hopefully we'll speak soon.
Thank you very much, Paul.
As I mentioned in the introduction, Philip has kindly allowed me to share Calvin's hypnosis session from 1993 with the legendary Bud Hopkins. Make sure you don't listen to this in the dark.
Calvin Parker's Hypnosis, Part 2. Bud Hopkins, March 14th, 1993. Once again, I am grateful to Dr. David Jacobs for supplying us with a copy of this tape. Bud Hopkins is probably the best-known researcher of such close encounter cases. Calvin Parker had another encounter in 1993. he remembered a considerable amount of what had happened while out on a small boat fishing one afternoon. It was a friend that persuaded Kelvin to seek out Bud, who was speaking at a UFO convention in Florida. Kelvin agreed, and he and his friend drove to Florida unannounced to meet Bud Hopkins. Bud put Kelvin under hypnosis at the hotel, and this is the recording of that session. This was the one and only time that Kelvin was regressed by Bud Hopkins. The date on the cassette tape is the 14th of March, 1993. Side 1. Bud begins.
Yeah. What kind of car was it?
1973 Rambler Hornet.
Oh, a new car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had just bought the car.
Mm-hmm. What color was it? Remember?
Yellow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess then you drove over and picked up Charlie, right?
Right.
And then you went off and you went to the, where was the first place you went to fish?
The grain elevator. The
grain elevator, yeah. Okay. And you didn't catch anything?
No.
And you decided to move on?
Right.
What were you fishing for?
Really, I don't think I was fishing for much or nothing. Yeah. Charlie was doing the fishing, yeah. And I was doing the talking.
He's the real fisherman.
He's
right?
The fisherman, yeah. Yeah. Right. Charlie really gets into fishing, yeah. And
but
I was
you had a pole
company.
When you were...
Oh, I had a pole, and it was off in the water,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
But I really wasn't... I didn't care if I caught one or not.
Yeah, right. And you were 19.
Right.
Okay. So then when you got into the shipyard, did you have to go in... I suppose it was some kind of a driveway or road into the ship.
Yes, it was a road that went in, and it was a lot of tall cane,
tree
cane around it.
Yeah.
So we drove down this road and parked.
Uh-huh.
And
how far would you say the car was from the pier where you were sitting?
I would say the car was 175 foot from the pier, 200 foot.
Uh-huh. You just walked down, you were sitting on the end of the pier?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, the car would have been closer than that because I stepped it off later on, and it was 125 foot to where the craft had landed.
Yeah.
And and the car was parked parallel with the craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, 125 feet or so.
Uh-huh.
Calvin, is this a kind of two-speed recording, like a slow speed, so you get double the amount on the tape?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Did I do that? Push
sure.
This little button right here, is that it?
I think I might have said it on slow speed.
I think it's on fast.
Yeah.
You can get twice the amount on it.
Right. Right, that's it right there.
I think you can get twice the amount.
Uh-huh.
You can go ahead and be recording all this.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to record the induction.
Right.
Yeah.
There might
not
be enough
time. Okay. I think that's pretty much... Now, you're wearing you said you had your T-shirt on and jeans or something like that?
Right, jeans. Let me take this thing off because it's choking.
Sure. Get yourself comfortable. You got your shoes off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I get it off.
Yeah,
bro. Okay. Okay. I don't know why you
wear this thing. Well. No. Calvin, we'll come back to that beautiful place another time. Right now, I just want you to enjoy this wonderful sense of relaxation. I want you just to feel that soothing flow through your body of warmth and relaxation. Feeling the warmth of the blankets, the safety, the room. Just you're feeling this sense of rest. So comforting, so safe. It feels so good. So allow yourself now to go even deeper into this wonderful feeling. Relaxation. Deeper into this wonderful feeling. Relaxation. Comfortable. Relax. Peaceful. Relax. In this relaxed state, your mind's so clear and so alert, Calvin. I want us to go back many years ago, 20 years ago almost, back to October 73. What I want you to do, first of all, see yourself as if you're looking into a big, big full-length mirror. I want you to see yourself as that 19-year-old young man. I want you to see the way you look. Look in that mirror. You're 19 years old. Perhaps your body's shaped differently. I want you to look at your body, your face, wearing your jeans and t-shirt. It's your hair. Look in that mirror. Look at your face and realize that you look at your eyes. How much more innocent the younger you look. 19-year-old. You've had some good times and you've had some difficult times. And you can see that right in your own eyes. Look in the mirror. Young man. Good times and some not so good times. You look a little different than now. You can look at yourself. Shoulders, your arms, hips, your legs. Now as we fade away from that image, just stepping away from the mirror, I want you to see part that by your place. I want you to look at that Rambler that you've got, that new yellow Rambler. It's a car you had a lot of fun with. It was exciting to get a car like that. I can drive around in it, have some fun with it. I want you to look at it, and if you're standing outside on the driver's side, You can speak whenever you like. I'd just like to ask you a question or two, Calvin. You're standing on the driver's side looking at the car, the yellow Rambler. You can answer this question for me. Is this a two-door car or a four-door? A four-door car. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you get in that car. You had your supper. You're going to go fishing with Charlie. You like to see Charlie and have good times. And Betty's. You're going to drive over and pick up Charlie. I want you to feel yourself getting in that car. When you slam the door of that car, it was a familiar sound. The cars sound very unique. You can always tell what that car sounded like when the door slammed. You can tell what it's like when you put the key in and you start it. It's funny, the engine turns over in a way to other cars. Sounds different than other cars. Just putting your hands around that steering wheel feels a certain way. It's your car. Really familiar. You drive over to Charlie. You're going to go pick up Charlie's after supper. You get over to Charlie's. Do you blow the horn out front, or does he just see you, or do you get out of the car and go in? You can speak.
I'm going to go in. The Blanche is going to cornbread. It's cornbread meal.
Right.
Charlie's raising all kind of hell with Blanche because she don't want to go off this evening. We've been off 2 or 3 days in a row fishing.
Mm-hmm. Let's get yourself back in the car there. Did you bring some cornbread out with you?
Mm-mm. No.
Okay, you're in the car there with Charlie and off you go. Tell me where you head first. Where are you going to go?
We stopped in Gauchet at a liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie went in and got the Bible with 10-year-old Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And came out and took a drink of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a drink too, or just Charlie?
Just Charlie.
Okay. So you're going to get, now let's see, you're sitting there in the driver's seat, and you're going to take off. See where you got heading. Pull out of the liquor store. Do you go left, or do you go right, or where do you go?
Go
left, okay. Let's just feel yourself driving along now. See where you're heading.
We're going toward a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And we stop at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I get some pigskin.
Mm-hmm.
And coat. And Charlie gets a 6-pack of Slits beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we drive on around town for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about fishing, but we're not generally plan on going fishing. We just talked about it. We just kind of want to get out and ride around.
Uh-huh.
So we had rode by Hardee's, and Charlie said that that's where Eddie used to work, right here. And you know, he's changed jobs and working for Shell. We want to work for Shell. Then we keep riding. Then we cross the long bridge. A lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
And we stop. Some little service station with a deep freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And the deep freeze is inside, and we buy some shrimp. And they're frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So when we turn around and we go back toward Gaucher, and we, Charlie tells me, he said, just turn right and go under the curve, and we'll go down this road, and we'll settle in the desert for a while. So we go down a dead-end street somewhere, and then we stop, and we sit there, and Charlie drinks a beer, and I think he's eating potato chips, pigs, and he tells me to turn around and go back to the next road.
Mm-hmm.
And we go down, Charlie comes and said, this is a grain elevator. This is where I've caught a lot of fish here. Let's try to fish here for a little while. So Charlie had his fishing equipment in the back seat, and mine was in the trunk. We got it out, and the shrimp was frozen. We had to sit there for a few minutes and try to get it unfrozen. There's some kind of little bugs all over us. And they're coming off the lights and out of the water, and just, you know, real stinging real hard, and we just can't stand it any longer.
Sure.
So he says, I know another place that we can go. We never fished any there. We never,
mm-hmm.
never did any fishing. We was waiting on the bait to fall out. Mm-hmm. So we sat there and talked until we just couldn't stand it. So he said, I know somewhere that we can go that's darker. And the lights is not as round as much, and we can fish. So we drive down the road, and it seems like we drive forever and ever and ever. Charlie's really starting to get on my nerves. He's starting to talk about Blanche, and he's talking about Sheila. How he hates who Sheila's seeing or dating or married to or something. Can't remember. He's just griping.
Yeah. You know? Family stuff.
Right. No, thank you, Lord. Wish I hadn't even came out tonight. Just gone back and go to bed. So we finally make it to a little road. We're going back out on the highway, and we turn. And Charlie said, this is the old shipyard, and I've never seen a no trespassing sign. And I said, Charlie, we're going to, we don't need to go in here. We could have some problems. He says, no, I come here and fish. I fish here all the time. I said, okay. I said, tell him to take you to jail, not me. On the way in, there's a car, a red Pontiac. With a black car. And there's someone that gets up out of the back seat. And I started laughing. I said, I know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing I should be doing.
anyhow, they got in the car still, and we drove down. I don't guess they paid much attention. I've never seen the car leave. And we parked. And I noticed it was tall cane. And I told Charlie, I said, Dad, if we ever want to get a fishing pole, this is where we need to come do it. And we set a few of them out along the bank. And we probably catch a fish. So we get our fishing equipment out and we go to an old rusty pier. And I remember being very careful stepping up on the pier because it didn't look like it probably hold much of us.
Mm-hmm. Just a minute, look down at the pier. Has it got holes in it? Or let's look at the wood it's just walking on.
Just at the back of it, it looked like the earth is washed away from the pier about 2 foot.
Mm-hmm.
We had to make a long step just to get back onto the pier.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an old board that had a nail turned up in it, old rusty looking nail. And I remember taking a hill and trying to kick the nail down, but I had on some tennis shoes and it wouldn't.
Couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it. It was just there. Charlie not to step on this limb.
See, look around as you're walking out. Do you see the bridge over there?
Yeah, see the bridge. There's a light all about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of traffic on the bridge. Trucks, and you can hear the noise coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a boat coming down the river. Charlie, but it was sound like an old generator running of some kind off one of these boats. There's a big Coast Guard boat right across the river.
Mm-hmm.
A big full bone. When I sat down and noticed how pretty it was, and it was quiet, there's no bugs around. And Charlie's really starting to piss me off now.
What's he saying?
Charlie's drinking a good deal, and it's really upset me because he's just still talking about his family. It don't seem like he can talk about anything else. He just wants to talk about his family. And like he's trying to run on to him. Ask Charlie, after Charlie, would you please shut your damn mouth and this fish? And I hear a noise from the back, and I think it's a car leaving. It's definitely leaving. And it has a peculiar thing around the tag on the car. There's something like a neon sign around the tag, and it's green, and it's red, and it's going round and round and round.
Can you see the tag on it? The license number?
Yeah. 1HV348 Jackson.
Mm-hmm. 1HV348
right,
Jackson.
Jackson County, Mississippi.
Huh. That's that red Pontiac with a black top.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's a fancy thing. See what's pulling out.
Someone's getting out of the car now. They stop. I told Charlie, I said, I gotta get to this. Go around to the bathroom before he leaves. So now he's getting back in the car and he's leaving. And then it's really quiet for a while. And I feel chill bumps starting to come up all over my back and back of my neck. And there's something wrong. I just, a bad feeling that something was really wrong. But I couldn't see anything because I turned and looked and there was nothing back there. So I started looking at the train tracks and I was noticing the train tracks, how peaceful it was. And I thought it was real strange that they left the tracks open. But I was thinking if a train came by, it'd run off in the river. And then Charlie telling me the legend. Thank God he's finally talking about something else besides his family. The legend of the singing river. For some reason, they all the Indians started singing and marched off into the river and drowned herself. And I said, well, Charlie must have dreamed this one up because I've never heard about this legend. But it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Did you say anything to Charlie about feeling funny?
No, I hadn't mentioned it. I thought maybe I was sick. But I knew I wasn't sick. I had chill bumps. Mm-hmm. I had a real eerie feeling.
Okay.
Before he finishes about the river, before he finishes telling the story, I turn and I look and there's blue lights, blue, hazy green lights. Charlie, they must be, you're in trouble now. We're trespassing and you're coming to get us. You're going to pay my way out of jail tonight because I didn't want to come down here to start with. Oh, they ain't coming after us. I hope not. But then the strangest thing, the light stopped. And then it was orange. And there was an orange glow all around mixed in with these blue lights. And I really got an eerie feeling then.
I just want you just to 1 minute now. I just want you to just right where you're sitting there, just let that feeling go over you. That eerie feeling that you described. Just let that go over you right now. I want you to notice the lights around you. Notice that those hazy lights. Let that feeling go over you. Just feel that feeling. Don't have to say anything. Just let that feeling go through you. Just try to describe now. Calvin, try to describe that feeling to me.
The feeling that I have.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like jumping into the water. It's swimming, running away or something, but it's so much stuff in here. I don't want to do that. I'll drown.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a good swimmer. Then Charlie, he's really getting upset.
Yeah.
Charlie threw his pole down, his fishing pole. I remember laughing because I got tickled. I said, oh, he's throwing his pole down. I wonder what he's going to do. That's like throwing one of his kids down. But then everything got real serious.
They both sitting? That's what's your posture here?
Charlie was sitting. I was standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie was trying to get up, but Charlie had too much to drink to get up very fast, and I was afraid he was going to fall off into the river and drown. So I reached and grabbed him by the shoulder, and I pulled Charlie back on the pier and helped him up. Now we're both standing and turning around.
Ever felt like this before?
No. No.
I'm telling you, body is, it has its own memory. Body remembers what it feels. I want you right now just to tell me what your body feels. You're gonna be able to remember exactly what your body feels. Whether you feel like you're running, you're moving, you're standing. Your body knows if you stretch. Tell me what you're feeling.
I feel the cramps all over, even the back of, all the way from the back of my legs to the back of my neck. Mm-hmm. And I can't control everything, and I'm being pulled. Mm-hmm. And these cramps, I've never felt nothing like this, not at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of pulling me down, and I can't move. I can't move at all. It's just drawing my body to. But it's coming from a noise.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't start until a noise started. There's a little low noise. I couldn't describe it if I wanted to. I couldn't make this noise again. It's so soft, but it's so harsh. And then this noise will start, and then it'll stop, and then it'll start, and then it'll stop. But every time this noise goes off, I feel the cramps coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed Charlie. I turned, the noise had stopped, and I turned and looked at Charlie. And he said, "My God, Calvin, what is this?" I said, "Charlie, why the hell are you asking me this? I don't know." So we're standing there, and I notice now that it's something really strange. It's so large, so big. And I still don't know how big it was. It's large as a football field, I guess.
So we don't have to worry about that. I'm interested in what you're feeling. You think you could make a run for the car?
I want to. But this thing is parked behind the car.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nowhere to go. I look to the left. I look to the right, and there's water on both sides, and there's water in front. And there's something behind my car. It looks like a train. It sounds like a train. But I don't have anywhere to go. All I can do is stay. I've got a gun in the front seat of the car. If I could just get to that. And I'm starting to go toward the car. And then it's a beam of light. The brightest light I've ever seen in my life. And shined on me and stopped. And I'm still thinking if I could get to my car, get to my gun.
Why don't you just walk past the beam?
I can't move. I'm paralyzed. I just
let's look at that light that you're in. Does the light have any color? Or is it just white?
It's blue. It's a blue light.
Mm-hmm. Bright blue?
Very bright.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like any blue I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sharp blue. And then there's an orange sitting on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Big orange light. It's real shiny.
What feelings are you having right now?
I'm not.
No feelings?
No feelings. I'm thinking. My body is just like it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just paralyzed.
Okay, you're feeling that paralysis now. Just feel like you're trying to move and you can't move.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now let's see what happens next.
There's something I don't recognize. Someone's coming. maybe it's not nothing, and so much talking coming out of the door. I'm thinking, well, this is just a joke someone's pulling, but they got a good one over on us. But then the closer and closer they get, I'm realizing how serious, what a serious situation that we're in. And there's something like I've never seen before in my life. It's coming toward us. It's one, two, three of them coming out the door. But it's one more standing in the door.
Now you might not see them too clearly because of the bright light, but you get a sense of their shape. What are they shaped like?
A football player.
Football player.
Yeah.
Broad shoulders.
Very broad shoulders. Long, long arms. But they don't have a face. There's still no face on the first one coming. And the second one has something, you know. My eyes were real, real blurry. And I noticed some black dots in front of my eyes. But the first one is still, he has hold of my arm. And there's a sting. I almost got sick of my stomach and I could throw up, but I couldn't throw up. And I felt a burning. The second he touched, it was a burning from all the way through me. And it felt like hot coals on me.
Now, if that one is close enough to touch your arm, what I want you to do, Calvin, I'm going to count to three, because you can lose your eyes enough. When I count to three, I want you to look firmly at the face. He's that close to hold you. You may, even though it's blurry, you may make out something. I'm going to count to three. Put my hand on your shoulder on the count to three, and that's a sign that everything's okay. You're just here with us. My hand's coming down your shoulder. So one, you're going to look at that face that's near you. Two, you're just about to look directly at him. Three.
There's like a glass plate. And it was like two marbles. Two blue marbles behind this glass plate.
Would the glass plate be like in a mask, is that what you mean? Or how would you describe it?
Well, it's just a glass plate and two marbles behind it.
You mean a round plate?
Mm-hmm, kind of round.
Like a dinner plate?
No, just clear glass.
Uh-huh.
And the marbles are sitting way to the back. It's a bit over, you're looking at a stage. And it's a black background, two marbles sitting.
What do you think those two marble things are?
I don't know. I get a feeling of peace. I was real frightened, and then I seen this, and I felt a feeling of peace.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, again, your body is extremely sensitive. You can know, you can just remember how you feel, how your body's moving, if it's stable. If you change position, if you sit down, your body's going to know if there's any movement. We know that there is some movement. Something happens, your body moves in some way. Tell me what you're feeling your body doing.
My knees. I feel the weight lifted off all my body as though I'm a balloon. And I'm floating. But I can see my knees. I had a patch on my jeans, and I'm able to bend over and look at this patch as though I'm a ball. And I feel myself floating.
How far away are your knees? Do you have to look straight down to see
them? No, right in my face.
Not close. Okay.
Never close. They're carrying me now.
You feel like your weight being supported by them?
But it's not a pain anymore. It's a relaxing feeling. It's as though I don't feel any pain at all. And I'm floating. I remember feeling this way a long, long time ago, like I was floating in air. I felt like I could fly, and this is the way that I feel, that I can fly. And I feel like if he let me go, I would fly. And they turned. I remember seeing Charlie.
What position is Charlie in?
Charlie's standing up. Then they again rotated around in a circle. Two or three times in a circle. And I remember feeling like a ball being dribbled.
You bounce up and down?
No. I felt the dribbling sensation. A turning. Like on a merry-go-round. Then a bright light. I can see through it now. Bright, bright light shining, and I'm being drawn to the inside of this light. But to the inside of what? Where am I going? Everything's so bright now. It's really bright. And I'm unfolding.
I'm sorry, you're unfolding, you think?
Yeah. My legs are starting to come back down. My arms are folding. And I'm standing up. But I don't feel anything under me. But I'm standing.
Feel your feet out resting on the floor?
No, I don't feel them resting on the floor, but they have to be. I feel a tugging on my arm. And then a very, very deep burning sensation going all through my body again. And this is where I prayed that I would die.
I want you to tell me just what you say. What is that prayer I just said right now?
Dear Lord, I don't know if we're there. This is the way things are supposed to be or not. But please just let me die. Please take me. Because anything has to be this. What am I getting into? But I couldn't physically say it, but I remember thinking this.
You think that? How many people that took you in? So far, you haven't had a chance to really say something to them. Let's just say right now you can say something to them. Just as if this is right now a chance to say something. What would you say to them at this point when they took you in there? What would you say? Say what you feel. What would you say to them?
Leave me the fuck alone.
Good. They have no right to do this, did they?
No.
Did they ask your permission?
No.
Okay. That's a good feeling. It's good, strong feelings. You guys, you have your rights. It's good to say that. Now what happens when you're standing there? What happens next? Your body's going to remember very, very well the very next thing it feels. What are you going to do? What's going to happen?
There's some kind of electrical charge. My feelings are coming back to my body, but I can't move. I can feel everything now. And it's cold. It's really cold. And then there's electricity. You could feel it coming through your body, just little electrical charges. But it don't hurt, but it stings.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of little balls bouncing on. Mm-hmm. Pretty. It's really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me a feeling of peace.
Mm-hmm.
Then I've been told what?
You've been told.
I'm being pulled now.
Uh-huh.
I'm being pulled.
Uh-huh.
And I hear a noise.
Uh-huh.
A loud noise. And it sounds like air releasing. And then I'm pulled into a room.
What's doing the pulling?
I don't know. I can't see.
Does it feel like there's a hand pulling you? That kind of thing?
No.
Mm-hmm.
As if a magnet was pulling me to this room.
Mm-hmm.
All I can do is see to the side. I remember
seeing
to the side.
Okay.
Being pulled inside.
Well, you don't have just to remember. You can actually look around and see what you can see. You can see it being, you can't move your eyes. You can't move your head. When you're going towards a room, do you go through a doorway, or how do you get into a room?
Oh, I went through a doorway, a wide doorway.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now I'm not afraid anymore.
Okay.
I'm mad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm scared. I'm mad. I'm wondering where I am. But I'm being pulled by something that I don't know what's pulling. And then I'm being strapped down. I'm strapped to this table. Big black straps. Just run around my legs, run around my arms, run around my stomach. And then I'm left alone. And I feel the adrenaline running through my body. Before I know I can break these straps. I'm breaking these straps here. That's the last thing I do. And I'm able to tug on them, and I'm breaking them, and I'm pulling on them. But I can't break them. Now I'm afraid. Now I know I have a problem. And again, I said, Lord, just let me die, because I know this is going to be a terrible death that I'm doing. Lord, just let me die now and get it over, because there's no need to go through a lot of pain. I don't like pain. And then I heard a noise and the door opened. And then a sense of peace fell all over me. I feel like real peaceful now. I feel like the struggle's over. I feel like I'm not able to move anymore. For some reason, I can't move in any direction. I just lay with my head forward and look. Oh, boy, this bitch is ugly. But I remember seeing a mask. Yep, she's got a mask on. Some kind of mask, and I could see why she was wearing a mask. I was able to talk.
Just now relax. Just take a very easy deep breath. Okay. Just at this point, you come to this point, take a very easy deep breath. Just feel yourself relax. That's good. Just easy deep breath. Just feel it, sense there you are, and you can feel the straps, but you're feeling very peaceful. You look at her, and you feel now you can talk. Did you say something to her?
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to her? Let's look at her while you say that. What do you say?
Who are you? That's all I said. That's all I could say is, who are you?
Did she answer?
She stuck her finger in my nose. And she... I don't know what. She's got an attitude, though. She's got a bad attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Just as soon as I get loose, I'm fixing to twist her head off. Real serious attitude on this bitch.
Well, you think she is? Kind of person. What's going through your mind when you look at her?
I've seen her before. I've seen pictures before.
Think you've actually seen her particularly before? You might have.
I've seen her before. I remember hating her. I hate her.
And let's just go with that for a second. I want you to get that sense of looking at her before, and I want you then to kind of look down at yourself and get a sense of how old you are. About a little boy or a teenager, or when you saw her before.
I just turned 6 years old. It was November the 7th.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see her? Where are you?
I'm in bed with my brother. I sleep with my brother now. We live in a small house. And he's bad about wetting the bed, and I get crapping, and I usually sleep on the floor, but he did this till he was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So he had wet the bed, and I had got up and laid down on the floor with a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen her.
Mm-hmm.